Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast, a very special edition, our best of podcast episode 1553 for Saturday, December 29th, 2018. Happy holidays and enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by On Deck. Are you a small business owner in need of capital today? Well, On Deck can help. With over $10 billion in loans and an A-plus rating from the Better Business Bureau, OnDeck is a lender you can trust. Visit ondeck.com/techguy to learn more and receive a free consultation with one of their U.S.-based loan specialists. Hey, welcome to the Tech Guy podcast. Normally, this is a radio show. I think you know that. Broadcast nationwide, about 300 stations. Actually, it's closer to 300 stations nationwide. What we've done for this, that we do a radio show and then we do a podcast. And what we've done for this is we've taken some of the best moments from 2018 from the radio show. We've put them all into one kind of special holiday podcast. This will be your one Tech Guy for this weekend. But I think you're going to enjoy it. Starting off with this little bit, somebody called me. He said, I'm an older fella and I want to learn how to code. I had some advice. Bill's in Pasadena, California. Hello, Bill.
Hey, Leo, how are you today?
I'm wonderful. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. I have sort of a two-part question. I'm 50 years old, and I'm considering a career change, and I'm thinking about learning coding. And I'm wondering what would be a good language to start, like Python or Ruby or something like that. And is it even worth it if I'm looking for work? Like, how would I get work when there's so many 20-somethings that already do all this stuff?
And they're cheap, right? And they're easy. But you may or may not – I think you can get work. There's huge demand. You're going to want to be very careful and pick an area where there's a need, right? So there's plenty of web front-end developers out there. But you're going to pick something that may – but all of this will be moot until you learn a language, although – the language you choose is even impacted by this. So I think a little research based, get out there, do some informational interviews, find out where there's a need. For instance, if there's a need for people who can write code for Windows in Visual Basic, then you would want to learn Visual Basic and Visual Studio on Windows. If you just asked me, I want to learn programming, I'm not necessarily focused on career. I might say Python is a great starting language to learn. And, of course, the other thing that impacts this is where do you learn? And there are a lot of courses for learning Python, even free courses out there. Java might be the single most useful language. Most systems programs are written in C++, a lot of big applications too. So it really is going to be a question of figuring out where there's demand, because as an older worker entering the marketplace – yeah, you're right. I mean, I'm older too. It gets harder and harder. Coding is particularly seen as a young person's game. But I think you have a lot of value to offer, but you've got to find the right niche. So figure out where there's demand. Learn the languages that are most useful in that area. That's where you start. You start with demand. There are lots of places you can learn online. This is the good news, free or inexpensively. And if you're motivated, if you're good at it and you love it, I think you can always find work. I really do. And it's a heck of a lot of fun to program. Out of time. Good luck. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy, 8888 Ask Leo. Back to the phones. We go line three. Neil, Phoenix, Arizona. Hello, Neil.
Hello, Leo. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Great. Well, happy Easter, first of all. And thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling. Happy Easter.
Yeah, we talked a couple weeks ago, and just so you know, I actually got the streaming problem solved by going to YouTube, so that works great, by the way.
Good. Yeah, YouTube is a good streamer, so I'm glad that works for you.
Yeah. Now, the question I had is this. I ended up trading up my iPhone 8 Plus to an iPhone 10.
All right.
I took the 8 Plus. And that's not really the question, but it just brings up an issue here, which is simply, or a question, which is, should I be using Wi-Fi calling rather than normal cell service if it's available to me?
Well, the cell company would like you to do that. I can tell you that right now. T-Mobile offers it. I'm not sure who else offers it. It is a capability of the phone itself, but unless your carrier gives it to you as an option, it's not going to make any difference if the phone can do it.
I have Verizon, and they offer it.
And they do offer it. So you could, if you think about it, you can imagine why Verizon might like it. It doesn't use their cell towers at all. It uses your internet access to make a phone call. Which eliminates congestion for them. And, good news, they could still charge you by the minute. You might or might not want to use it. It doesn't. It's going to go against your own bandwidth wherever you are, whether you're at work or at home or at a coffee shop. It's going to count against that bandwidth. Nowadays, I don't think that's a big issue for most people. We have so much bandwidth. If we have bandwidth caps, that it's not going to be a big deal. Quality could vary. If you're on a poor connection, you'd rather be on the cell phone. Because that the standard for audio quality on the cell phone is consistent, pretty much, less so on Wi-Fi. So, but if you're at home and you know your Wi-Fi is good, the call should sound good. And in some cases, I don't know about Verizon. I know with T-Mobile, sometimes my Wi-Fi calls sound spectacular because T-Mobile is using more bandwidth than they would normally use. The whole phone system.
I'm on the Wi-Fi right. I'm on cellular right now as I talk to you. That's a comparison.
Yeah. So you're on cellular right now.
Yes.
Yeah. Your Wi-Fi might sound better. You should try it and see if you sound better. If you do, that would be maybe the one argument for doing that. Mostly, this is to benefit the cell companies. It would benefit you also if you had a weak cell system. You know, what weak cell signal where you are. You know, the Wi-Fi signal might be better. We have, for instance, many of my employees have T-Mobile. I use T-Mobile, and there's no T-Mobile signal inside our offices here. So we got from T-Mobile a special device that converts, you know, that so basically becomes a Wi-Fi tower, a cell tower with Wi-Fi access. And so we don't even have to have Wi-Fi calling to use it. It just looks like a cell tower, but it's really just using our Wi-Fi. And that gives us, you know, lots of what looks like cellular bandwidth inside the studio. So, you know, and that's a case where Wi-Fi calling might be of value. I think the only benefit really is, you know, the strongest benefit is to the company because they're not paying for cell bandwidth. But if you see it sounds better or if it works better for you in some locations, go ahead and use it. Get it?
Thank you very much for the call.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for the question. That's a great question, actually. You know, unless somebody can tell me a reason why it's better for you, I think it really, the reason they offer it is it's better for the company. Is there any reason you could think of it? If you have a poor signal, I guess, and if I don't think Verizon does this actually. I think Verizon sounds the same. The whole quality of your phone calls is very low, isn't it? And it goes back to the time that Ma Bell set up phone service in the United States. I mean, we're talking 100 years ago, and they wanted to figure out what's the lowest quality we could use and still be intelligible. And it turned out to be very low quality. It wasn't digital. It's analog, so I can't. It's not, you know, 4-bit or 6-bit, but it's about comparable to 4-bit sound. It's very low quality. You know, phone calls sound like this. But what the engineers figured out is, well, the human ear is pretty good at distinguishing what somebody's saying if they sound like this. So we're going to use that quality. And that all makes sense back then. But here we are nowadays with much, you know, basically unconstrained bandwidth, especially if you're on Wi-Fi. Calls could sound really good. They could sound at least as good as they do on Skype. Skype's a good example. You know, Skype, if you have a lot of bandwidth on both sides of the call, you sound like you're in the same room. Chris Marquardt, we just talked to him. He's in Germany. And we're talking in real time. It sounds like he's in the studio. Studio quality over Skype. He's got a good microphone. I have a good microphone. We both have lots of bandwidth, so it's ideal Skype conditions. But Skype doesn't have that artificial limitation. But I have to say, when you use Wi-Fi on a cell phone, in some cases, they still limit it to really that kind of low bandwidth sound because that's what people are used to. And it is a little disorienting. My daughter and I both have Wi-Fi calling on T-Mobile. We both use it at home. And when she calls me, she sounds so much better than on the phone. And at first it's like, whoa, are you here? Are you in the room? And then I eventually go, oh, that's Wi-Fi calling. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 ask Leo, reboot your router. The FBI says You don't usually get tech advice from the FBI. They say, reboot your router. this is a kind of interesting story. The FBI uncovered a Russian virus called VPN Filter that has infected, they say, as many as 500,000 routers. I'll tell you the brands, but in my opinion, everybody probably should just reboot their router tonight before you go to bed or whatever. Just unplug it, wait 5 seconds, plug it back in again. That's all you need to do. Shouldn't affect anything, but it will clear out the virus. The virus can only live in memory. And a number of Linksys routers are affected. MikroTik, Netgear, QNAP, and TP-Link. But, you know, and you can find the model numbers if you go to a Symantec site. Actually, you know what? I'll put this on the Tech Guy website, techguylabs.com, if you want to see if your router is affected. But I think that's a limited list that is perhaps not complete. Woman in Pittsburgh gave the FBI permission to monitor her network. She had an infected router. And the FBI was able to figure out how the software worked. Very clever. So routers are computers, but they're not smart computers. And they don't generally have permanent storage. So the virus didn't have a space to put itself. So what it did is it put a little bit, they could store permanently a little bit in the firmware of the routers, of the affected routers. And that little bit loaded the rest of the virus into memory. Rebooting your router just clears the memory out, and the router's clean, except that there's that little bit of software which will then try to reload the virus, VPN filter, right? So when in the past, if you'd rebooted your router, it would just reload the virus and continue on. What is the virus doing? Well, it's not attacking you, almost certainly. It's the Russians don't care about you, but they want to use your router to attack infrastructure and the internet. And who knows what infrastructure they're attacking. Could be, and we actually think this is probably the case, like the power grid in the United States. Oh, yeah, get ready, because cyber warfare is really becoming going to become a problem. Russians use the Ukraine as a test bed. They've already knocked out the power grid in Ukraine for a couple of hours, kind of a test, using malware. And they've done other things in Ukraine. And this is kind of a test bed for cyber capabilities that they would presumably want to use against enemies. And guess who's number one on the list? It's us. So Fancy Bear, which is a Russian hacking group, best known for hacking the DNC, getting John Podesta's emails, Fancy Bear created this VPN filter. It's taken over, according to the FBI, 500,000 routers. I bet you it's more, and I bet you it's not just the routers that listed on the Symantec page, but many more. So I would say take the FBI's advice no matter what router you're using. When you go to bed tonight, unplug it, wait 5 seconds, and plug it in. The reason I say wait till tonight is you'll take yourself off the internet briefly, like for a minute or two as the router reboots and starts up again. The reason it's safe to do that now is because the FBI watched what was happening at this Pittsburgh woman's house and figured out that the malware, the little tiny bit of malware that's permanent in your router, was doing two things. First, it went to a site called photobucket.com. And this is a well-known site. A lot of people use it to do photo sharing. And there were two malicious images on Photobucket. And I guess in the metadata of the image, the malware was contained, is what I gather from the FBI report. Although it's hard to tell, you know, the FBI doesn't, you know, it's not. I need to see a white paper, you know, something with a little more technical detail. But that's what it sounds like. Somehow they were using these two images to infect routers. FBI took those images offline, and also coded into the firmware is, and this was the mistake that the Russians made, Fancy Bear made, is a link to a hard link to a site called toknowall.com. You know, usually malware authors and in more sophisticated malware, we've seen this, they have other means of going out and getting information, because the problem is if it's hard coded to one site, the FBI can do what it did, which is issued a warrant to, I think it was VeriSign that owns the DNS. Remember we were talking about the phone book lookup, the DNS record for toknowall.com, and they took it over, effectively severing the link between the virus and your router. So you can safely reboot your router. It will try to go to PhotoBucket, not find those photos. Then it will try to go to KnowAll.com and get nothing. And meanwhile, the FBI is going to see every single one of you who goes there and know who's infected. That's why maybe that number is accurate. I don't know. Because you're going to go there, they probably can see what brand of router it is and so forth. But for the good news is it won't get reinfected. And whatever bad stuff the Russians planned, Fancy Bear planned, with your router will be thwarted. But boy, this is just the beginning. This is prepare yourself. We already know that most of the nation's infrastructure, its power grid, is infected or has been attacked, but in many cases already been infected by malware. The Russians are no different from other high-level hackers. They know how to use your router and other Internet of Things devices. And the real threat is not to you. Yes, your Internet of Things light bulb or microwave oven or router or camera can be used to get into your network, but that's really, they don't care about you. What they want to do is create an army of bots that can be used to attack other things. And if you have access to 500,000 routers that can send pings out to a single website, you can bring any site down, including those big domain name servers, the phone book of the internet, and bring the entire internet down. So you're doing us all a service if you reboot your router tonight. Everybody, just as you go to bed, unplug it, wait 5-10 seconds, plug it back in. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888, Ask Leo. In the chat room, good advice from Cheese Soda Punch. Probably not his real name. Cheese Soda Punch says, don't forget, when you're back there, unplugging and plugging in your router, it might be a good time, you could do that right now, to update your router firmware. This is unfortunately something you have to do manually on a lot of older routers. Modern routers should do this automatically, and I would not consider buying a router that did not. In fact, let me broaden that. I would not consider buying any Internet of Things device, any Internet-connected device that didn't automatically update itself. Because you shouldn't have to check one by one to see if your light bulbs, microwave oven, doorbell, router are up to date. But if you have an older router, and most routers are, sad to say, you should check. Make sure you have the latest firmware, because one of the things I'm sure router manufacturers will do is patch their routers to make sure they're not vulnerable to this VPN virus. So yeah, maybe a little project for the weekend. Check your router firmware. And next time you buy an Internet of Things device, make sure it automatically updates. And the company's aggressively updating it. That's another thing. You know, you want a good company that's going to update. A lot of these router companies, they make these things, they put them out, and they say, that's it, I'm done. Bye. See ya. That's not good. My new motto is never buy a DVD again. Scott, that's Scott Wilkins. I like to make him laugh. He's so cute. Scott Wilkins in the Santa Claus of home theater geeks.
Is coming up, too.
It is. Your time is coming. He bears gifts. All the time, he joins us each week to talk about AV, which is, of course, not just your big screen TV, but also your surround sound and all of that. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Leo. How you doing?
Always a pleasure.
Always glad to be here.
Somebody asked last week, and I think it would be good for us to talk about QLED, which is Samsung TVs are QLED. They have some very nice QLED TVs, and OLED. And I think the only difference between a Q and an O is just that little tail there, right?
Yep, that's exactly right. And it is confusing, I have to tell you.
They're completely different technologies, though.
They are completely different technologies. OLED, O-L-E-D, stands for Organic Light-Emitting Diode, and that is the technology by which the TV makes its picture. And the organic, by the way, isn't because, you know, it's green and grass-fed or anything like that. it's based on organic chemistry. You remember in high school or college, you might have taken organic chemistry and inorganic chemistry?
Yes. Organic has carbon in it.
That's right. That's it. That's what organic LED, OLED, that's how it makes its light.
It's a carbon-based life form like us. Little Star Trek mention in there.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Very good. Very good. now, QLED The Q in QLED stands for quantum dots.
Well, that's not anything like organic.
No. In fact, they are typically inorganic.
And in fact, really, QLED is just an LCD.
That's correct.
Let's be honest.
It's an LCD TV like every other LCD TV on the market, with one exception. And that is that the light source behind the LCD panel is using quantum dots as in addition to LEDs, light-emitting diodes, these little bright things that you can buy and see everywhere, and flashlights and everything. Basically, they have LEDs as the light source.
They're the backlight. So LCD screens, people need to understand, the LCD is a liquid crystal shutter that opens and closes very rapidly to let light through.
Yep,
and
more,
so it needs,
or less light through.
Or less, and it needs a backlighting source.
Correct.
Used to be fluorescent lights. Those weren't very good.
Little fluorescent tubes like in office lights.
Yeah. We now use
now
LEDs.
They use LED.
So what is a quantum dot? Is that still an LED or is it something else?
No, it's something else. It's a microscope. We're talking about nanomaterials here. It's a microscopic sphere of a particular semiconductor. I forget exactly which semiconductor, but they're typically in the 2 to 5 nanometers in diameter range. So they're very, very tiny. Now, when a quantum dot receives a photon from an LED or any light source, and particularly a blue photon, it absorbs it, thinks about it for a second, and then spits out a red or a green photon.
Well, that's amazing.
It is amazing. And so you put a
bunch. So it's basically a filter.
It's what's called a color converter.
Uh-huh.
So blue comes in and red or green comes out. And whether or not it's red or green depends upon the size of the quantum dot.
It's magic.
So a certain size of quantum dot will absorb a blue photon and spit out a green photon. And a different size will absorb a blue photon and spit out a red photon. So you put a bunch of these, billions of them, you embed them in a film, and you put blue LEDs behind them, and you irradiate them with blue light. Many of them will absorb that blue light and send out red or green. Now, some of the blue light actually makes it through the film without getting absorbed. And so you end up with blue light, red light, and green light.
Which,
and what are those three colors together combined to make?
Any color in the rainbow.
Well, white, actually.
Oh. Altogether. But if you vary them in different shades, you can get different colors.
Yes, and that's exactly how LCD TVs work.
Okay, because you have a shutter, but the shutter doesn't do any coloration. It just turns a pixel on or off.
And here's the really weird thing is you have quantum dots, red and green, and blue LEDs that combine to make white. They go through these LCD shutters.
Yeah.
And then they go through color filters.
Oh, later. So you're just using the quantum dots to make white.
Correct. Correct.
Is it a better white than just an LED?
It is. It is.
How?
It is. In many ways, it is. Because the spectrum of red, green, and blue, the red, green, and blue parts of the spectrum are very peaky. They're very narrow, and they can be very wide. So you can get a much wider color gamut or range of colors than you can from a white LED.
I thought white was white. It's not.
Yes, it's not. It's not. It
depends. So it's a better white.
It is. It is. Now, white from the sun, for example,
is
white
yellow.
Light.
Yeah.
It's kind of yellowish.
Yeah.
But it's got a very broad spectrum.
Okay. So there's the temperature, which we talk about, which can be blue or yellow. That's
color temperature.
Color temperature.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing. That's why we say it's yellow. But then there's how much of the spectrum is available in that light.
Correct.
Oh,
correct.
I didn't know that. That's interesting.
And the wider the spectrum that you can reproduce, the more range of colors you can reproduce.
I thought white was just every color all smushed together, but it's not.
It can be made in many different ways. That's the really – because
– and we're not talking about the white when your wife says, oh, I want ivory white
versus
I want clamshell white.
Right.
We're talking about pure white.
Right. Of a very specific. And in fact, white can have colors, as you have said. And the color that you want a TV to produce, the color of white, has a very specific name. It's a technical name called D65.
Oh.
Which has it really is a very neutral white. And that's what you want, because that's what the content creators used. That was the color of white they used in their monitor when they were making the content.
That's what really matters, is to reproduce the colors that the person who made the content wanted.
Yep.
Accurately.
Yep. Exactly right. Yeah. And so at these
D65, by the way, is the average midday light in Western Europe.
Really?
Yes.
Well, that I didn't know.
I didn't either. It's 6,500 degrees Kelvin. Kelvin.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Isn't that strange?
Exactly.
Okay.
So QLED then is this very complicated LEDs behind LCD panels using quantum dots and so on and so forth. It's a specific name that Samsung uses for its quantum dot based LED illuminated LCD TVs.
So maybe they're not trying to confuse people. It's just that QLED is an LCD technology, which is a completely different way of creating a picture than an OLED, which is a direct emission pixel.
Correct.
Each pixel emits a color.
Exactly. And in that sense, the LCD is a transmissive technology. Light has to pass through something.
Right.
Whereas OLED is an emissive technology. Light is emitted directly from the screen.
Okay.
And it has
they have different characteristics.
Yeah, yeah. Well, LCDs are brighter.
QLED's cheaper. LCDs are cheaper.
Generally speaking, yes. However, they don't have as wide a viewing angle.
That's what some people say, but that has nothing to do with the Q in the QLED. That just is because it's an LCD screen versus an OLED screen.
Yep, yep, okay. Exactly right. Exactly.
Scott,
right.
You've made it, as usual, clear as mud, and I thank you. You confuse me more. No, I am, but it's important to understand there is a distinction.
It is.
Between OLED and QLED. They're completely different ways of making a picture.
Completely, yep.
Home theater geek, Scott Wilkinson. Thank you, Scott. Let's say hello. Hello to
Jose
in Ontario. Hello, Jose.
Hi, Leo. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Great. Thank you. Love your show.
Thanks for listening. I appreciate it.
And my concern is with my laptop. I just want to make sure that I'm secure and nobody is snooping in. So what do you suggest?
And you're talking about when you use it in a coffee shop or a hotel or somewhere where there's Wi-Fi, public Wi-Fi. Is that what you're talking about?
Right. Yeah, here at home, I guess I'm secure.
Well, the first thing I would do with any laptop, really I do it with anything, is turn on the encryption built into the laptop. On Mac, it's called File Vault. On Windows, it's called BitLocker. If you don't have, if you have Windows Home and you don't have BitLocker, sometimes the hard drive will have its own encryption. And that the purpose of that is if you lose the laptop. So if you lose the laptop and the person can't log in, they can't use it, but then maybe they take the drive out and access it, and this prevents them from doing that. So hard drive encryption is very important. It doesn't help you, though, in that coffee shop scenario, because once you're logged in, the contents of the – obviously, or you wouldn't be able to use it, the contents of the hard drive is decrypted. And you can access it, and so could a bad guy. So you're right. You want to sign. You kind of want to secure your laptop. People talk about using a VPN, a virtual private network. That has some benefit because a VPN, you're connecting to a server somewhere out there. Usually, it could be at your house, but it more often is a company that provides VPN service. You're connecting to them, and everything you do between your laptop and their computers is encrypted. And then, of course, from their computers, it has to go out into the outside world normally. But that means anybody who's sniffing the traffic, sniffing the Wi-Fi going through the air, can't see what you're doing. That's true, though. You know, nowadays, when almost all websites are encrypted, if you use Facebook or Google, if you're buying something on Amazon, if you're visiting your bank, they're encrypted anyway. So all a bad guy could see is that you're on Amazon. He couldn't see what you're doing. There are other threats, though. I don't want to scare people, but there are other threats that you can encounter. Let's say you're in a coffee shop, you're sitting there, and there is a bad guy. And this is somewhat – this is not your run-of-the-mill bad guy. This has to be a somewhat skilled bad guy. But he's sitting there. And most of the time, by the way, these guys are doing it for fun, not profit. But let's say he's sitting there. And he's got a device. There are many, but there's one that's widely available, inexpensive, easily purchased, called a Wi-Fi pineapple. He's got this Wi-Fi pineapple. And among other things, even if you're on a VPN, even if you're encrypted, visiting Amazon or Google or Facebook, he can see your app laptop, and he can sometimes do things like, this is really creepy, figure out what your normally visited access points are, like your home or your office, and then impersonate it from the pineapple. Your laptop goes, oh, we're home, and joins it. And now he's done something called a man in the middle. He is in the middle of your conversation with the outside world. That's a little risky. So ideally what you would use is not just a VPN, but also a router, a device that's not, see, what you'd like to do, this is really going the extra mile, but what you'd like to do is turn off Wi-Fi on your laptop, connect your laptop via an Ethernet cable to a router, and have the router be in the outside world. The router is dumb. It can't share any information about you, including what kind of operating system you're running or anything.
Okay.
So that, if you really want security, that's the way I'd go. And I always recommend a company called Tiny Hardware Firewall. And they make hardware routers for this purpose. They include with it, they bundle with it VPN service and Tor service, which anonymizes you. And those devices, they're $30, $40, $50. You own that, and then you pay for the VPN service. Really are the best way. Tiny Hardware Firewall. And this is one of them. I'll show you. This is their most... They sent me this the other day. This is their most recent one. This is on the front page of Tiny Hardware Firewall. They call this the Kadesh. K-E-D-E-S. They have strange names. THF. So what this is a router. It actually looks like a router. It's powered via USB, so you could actually power it from your laptop if you wanted to, plug it in the USB port. It has three Ethernet ports, but it also has two Wi-Fi radios in it. And so what you do is you power this up, you connect to it. It's got a little web server in there that lets you connect to it. And you join the Wi-Fi network at the Starbucks or wherever you are. And that includes these tricky little things they do called captive portals. You know, the login screens you see that you have to either pay money or just sign in and say, I agree to abide by your terms of service, that kind of thing. Those are called captive portals. This will handle that. This signs in. This is what's signed in. And then it's connected via, best way to connect via Ethernet, but you could do it via Wi-Fi as well, connects to this. And so this becomes a barrier to the outside world. It also, you don't have to use VPN. In fact, probably this is sufficient. But if you wanted to get extra security, you can turn on VPN. If you want to get anonymization, if you want privacy, or you want to appear to be coming from somewhere outside the U.S., you can use Tor on this as well. Both of those are built in. And you get... And so when you buy the hardware, you get the service. You also have to buy the VPN service from them. They have other packages. I carry these around. They have other devices you'll see on the website, including one that's let's see if I can find it here. One that's just a USB, looks like a thumb drive. This is a little more compact. People like this maybe a little bit better. It's called a micro router. You just put that in, and it does the same thing. You join the Wi-Fi. And then it goes into your computer hardwired. So you can, in effect, turn off Wi-Fi on your computer, which is the best thing to do, frankly. If Wi-Fi is not on your computer, you're pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
You're pretty good. So these are inexpensive hardware devices. This one, I think, they call this the Boudica. I think it's $30. And then their VPN service is about $90 a year.
Okay.
So the NSA should require everybody use this. Actually, they shouldn't let anything out of the house, but since they do, they should require this. So this is really hardcore. This would protect you against a lot of malicious bad guys, even very sophisticated attackers. Most of the time, it's not necessary. You know, honestly, a lot of the time, I just trust that I'm using encrypted websites, HTTPS websites, and presume that there's not somebody sitting there with a Wi-Fi pineapple attacking me. I think that's fairly safe. But if you really say, no, I want to lock it down, encrypt your laptop and buy one of these devices. Good advice on how to stay secure online. And that, some of the things we talk about on the Tech Guy Show change over time. That one's been remarkably consistent over the years. I think things will change a little bit in the next couple of years as 5G arrives and WPA3, which is a new Wi-Fi encryption technology. But, you know, the fundamentals aren't going to change. I don't know if people will. I think more and more you're going to see people using VPNs built into their devices, actually. Google's already doing that. There are people like Cloudflare who are offering kind of privacy settings that you could put in your iPhone or your Android phone. So maybe the world is changing a little bit. But for now, that's how you stay safe on Wi-Fi. I want to interrupt just a moment to remind you that the show has a sponsor, and we're brought to you today by our sponsor, OnDeck. OnDeck is 100% committed to small business owners like us with fast, easy, tailored financing. If you're a small business owner, you know that there are times, this is a good time of year for this actually, where you want to ramp up, you want to build more widgets or staff up for the holiday season. You know you're going to get a lot more customers, but you're not going to get the money right away. So there's a little, you need a little bridge between spending the money and getting the money. And that's where a nice loan is very handy. Now, there are lots of ways to do this. I think most of us probably just put it on our credit card. Don't. Those interest rates are crazy. Maybe you go to a bank. Hey, look, your time's valuable. You don't have time for that. With OnDeck, you can get funding as fast as 24 hours, term loans up to $500,000, lines of credit up to $100,000, and unlike a lot of lenders, no business collateral required. The application process couldn't be easier. You can apply online or by phone. You will get approved fast because, frankly, when you make the decision, I know you want the money now. I need it today. I got to make payroll, whatever it is, right? And really important, this will not impact your personal credit. OnDeck is a great company. I just want you to know this because you might say, well, OnDeck, who are they? They've got some of the best customer service in this business, U.S.-based loan specialists, an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau, A-plus, all right? And they've been around a long time. They've lent over $10 billion to over 80,000 small business owners. Trustpilot gives them 9.8 out of 10. You don't get better than that. OnDeck, it's a secure financing service that businesses everywhere can trust and rely on. Their simple and secure web platform, their mobile app make it very easy to know how you stand, where your account is, anywhere, anytime. Look, I am a small business owner. I know what it's like. If you're a small business owner and you need access to capital, there's no shame in that. Just do the right thing. Go to ondeck.com/techguy right now. As a listener, you'll get a free consultation with one of their U.S.-based loan specialists. Apply online or on phone and get approved in minutes. And by the way, you'll feel good afterwards. OnDeck takes a lot of the worry out of the holiday season. ondeck.com/techguy. ondeck.com/techguy. Get that free consultation. Stop worrying. Start enjoying the holidays. ondeck.com/techguy. We thank them for their support of the Tech Guy podcast. On we go with the show. Let's talk about spy cameras. How small can they go? Carrie on the line from Lake Arrowhead, California. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, I love your show.
Thank you.
So cool to be on. But I have a question. Do you have or know of a pen that can that's a camera that can video a program when you're, you know, like, or a meeting? I want it for meetings. It's a like an ink pen. You know, you can stick it on your pocket.
Ah, you want to secretly record that exit interview with that jerk of a boss. Is that what you want to do?
Exactly.
Yeah, so the trade name for small cameras until recently was lipstick cams because they were about the size of a lipstick, but now they make them even smaller. They call them, there's a variety of names for them, but you can buy, and I have one, actually, I carry it around in my briefcase, a camera. It's not super small, but it's fairly unobtrusive. They call them nano cameras. They're what are they? How can I describe it? They're the size of a cigarette butt. How about that? That's disgusting, but that's
great. Yeah, I love it.
And they're inexpensive. You can buy them on Amazon, a lot of places. Most of them have a USB connector at the other end, so you'd connect it to something that had a USB port. They record high fidelity, 1080p high def. They tend to be a little wide angle, but that's because you want it to get the whole room in. I'm trying to remember what the brand name. I think the one I got was a Chinese kind of off brand, and it was like $10. If you look they're really cheap. If you look on Amazon for mini cam, you'll see a bunch of surveillance cams. I think what's powered this. Oh, here's one that goes in a pen. Exactly what you wanted. Look at this mini camera pen, $27 on Amazon. The reason that these are now so prevalent is because of smartphones, right? Smartphone cameras are actually very small. Ooh, here's one. You plug into a plug. It looks like a USB charger with a tiny little dot above it. But it's really, it's a camera. So, this is, I take it back. There is even better stuff than I thought out there. Now, I'm sure there are laws regulating the use of these. I don't know what they are. And I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not going to attempt to caution you in any way. But I would only say, think about it before you do it. I like this one. This is my favorite. It's called the Safari Special Edition. You go in the room. You say, "Oh, hey, do you mind? I want to plug in my laptop. I need to, or my phone. My phone's almost dead. Can I plug in the charger?" It looks like a USB phone charger. You could even have a USB cable in it and plugged into your phone. But right above it is the tiniest camera I've ever seen. $37. It's called the Safari Special Edition USB wall charger, hidden camera. There's also some pen cameras. Everything's out there now, man.
I love it. I love your show. Thank you.
Thank you. Good luck with the awful boss.
Yeah.
I hope he says something criminal during your conversation that you can nail him with.
He has already, and I never can.
Oh, I was making that up. It's true, huh? It's unfortunate. You know what's sad? It's unfortunately really common. And I'm sorry that you have to put up with that. And good luck in fighting it.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
And now everybody, when somebody comes into a meeting with you and says, "Hey, you mind if I charge my phone?" Or just sit a little to the left so my pen can get a good view of you. You might want to think twice. 8888-ASK-LEO, the phone number on the line from San Gabriel, California. We got Pete. Hello, Pete.
Hello, Leo. How are you doing?
Wonderful. How are you?
Oh, good. Listen, I got a Amazon Fire HD 8 with 30 gigabyte.
Yeah.
What I have on the phone is I have my Solitaire, Sudoku, and my Yahtzee.
Yeah.
I wanted to change it to that so I could free my phone, but I don't see a way unless I got them through Google Play. All the
So what you do on the Amazon Fire, it doesn't come, as you've noticed, with the Google Play Store. This is actually a interesting story. The Amazon Fire tablets are Android, but they're so in order to understand how they could be Android, you have to understand that Android originally wasn't a Google product. It was created by a company called Android,
right?
Sold to Google, and it was open source. That meant that, and Google has kept it that way. That means anybody can go online, download the code for Android, and put it on any device they want. Many people do, but that's called the open version of Android, the Open Handset Alliance version, OHSA.
Right.
That, however, doesn't include any of the Google stuff. Most importantly, the Google Play Store or Google Chrome or, any of the Google apps.
Mm-hmm.
You can, however, on the Fire, download the Google apps, but you have to know how to do it.
Yeah.
It doesn't come with it, but Google, truthfully, doesn't mind, in fact, if you think about it, it's in their interest that you get the Google Play Store because they make money every time you down, you know, you pay for an app there. So it's possible to install the Play Store on the Fire tablet. And it basically involves two things. First of all, turning off the setting that says only download stuff from the Amazon store. That setting is an important setting because it protects you. It keeps you from downloading stuff from sketchy app stores. So it is a setting available in all Android devices, including the Google devices. And by default, it's switched on.
Okay.
So the first thing you have to do is and that's getting apps from another's store is called sideloading. So the first thing you have to do is go into settings and security and say enable the apps from unknown sources. Now, my suggestion is once you do this, turn it back on. It's a good thing to have. It'll protect you.
Now, when I bring the screen down from that gives me the – I'm on Belkin 220UC router right now, so I'm getting the signal from that.
Yep.
It shows Bluetooth, airplane mode, blue shade, and then do not disturb and help. Nothing shows me anything.
Go to the settings in your tablet.
Okay. Now, how do I get into the settings of the tablet? This is brand new to me.
Yeah. And it is a little challenging because it doesn't actually look like Android at all. So it is a little challenging. Yeah, you see it in the carousel there?
Yeah, hold on a second.
It's in the carousel.
Okay, settings. Okay.
Yep. And then there's a security tab.
Security.
Yeah, I'll tell you what. I don't want to take the time to walk you through it, but you'll find it. And then enable in apps from unknown sources. Then that's step one. Then step two is you've got to find the unknown sources. And there's four things you need. You need the Google account. I mean, actually, this may change because Google's always fiddling with this. But as of a few months ago, and I'll put a link at the show notes at techguylabs.com that gives you the links to this. You get it from something called APK Mirror. APK is the name of an Android app. It's an APK. And APK Mirror is... You want to be very careful doing this, downloading APKs from random. People can download malware. But in this case, APK Mirror is a trusted source. But be very careful. You're going to need four things. Google Account Manager, Google Services Framework, Google Play Services, and then finally you can install the Play Store. This can be a little tricky depending on which version of the Fire tablet you have, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm going to put a link in our show notes from a site called the How To Geek that gives you step by step what I just described and the file links to the actual files you need. And so follow that fairly carefully. You want to do it in that order. You want to, in other words, treat it like a cookbook recipe. Don't deviate, and you should be fine. Once you have the Play Store on there, then uncheck that box because it's unsafe. But the Play Store also will have that, you know, protection. You should only get stuff, ideally, you should only get stuff from the Amazon store and the Play Store. Both of those stores are carefully vetting, somewhat careful, not 100% carefully, but carefully vetting their stuff and making sure you don't get malware on there. And you really want to be careful. As with, you know, this is true of all computing devices. Be very careful about where you get them, you know, where you get your software from. Don't download software from random sources or just because there's a link on your screen that says, hey, you need the new Flash. Don't just say, oh, okay, that must be true. You got to be careful about this stuff because that's exactly how malware gets on your system. And there is a lot of malware on the Android platform, and that is an Android device. He's been everywhere, man. He's Johnny Jett. He is our travel guru. Helps us use technology to travel better. JohnnyJett.com, and he joins us every week. Hello, Johnny.
Hello, Leo.
I'm getting ready to travel.
I know you are. I'm very jealous of your trip to Japan.
You know, I've been there briefly to Nagasaki and I think one other town, but this is going to be the real trip, you know, Tokyo and Osaka and Kyoto.
You've never been to Tokyo before?
Never been to Tokyo.
Wow.
But, you know,
that surprised me.
I want to see the countryside, too. There's a lot of beautiful countryside, isn't there?
The countryside's the best.
Everybody talks about the cities.
Yep.
But the countryside's gorgeous.
My favorite is Kinosaki.
Kinosaki.
So it's about I think it's like an hour outside of Kyoto. I can't remember. It was a while ago since I've been there. But there's no Westerners there. Everyone's walking around in wooden clogs because it's a spa town. And they're walking around in their robes.
Oh, I'm going there.
And there are
there.
All these different spas. And I actually had
spa town. That's where I'm going.
But you got to be naked in these things. And there's some co-ed. And so got to make sure in advance. And I was staying at this Ryokan, which is a traditional hotel you know, you're sleeping on the floor on a little tatami mat.
Yeah.
And it was I was like, what? And you have to go down the hall to use the bathroom. It was one of the best experiences of my life. At first, I was skeptical.
Yeah.
But in this one Ryokan, they have a spa where and there's a tradition. So you need to read up on like how to wash yourself before you go in because there's a lot of different rules
and traditions. Stuff. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, but one time I went in. So I went in the first day and I did it. And the next day I went down and went into the same one. And all of a sudden I'm in there, you know, scrubbing myself on a little stool. And a woman rolls in and screams. And I'm like, oh, my God, she just went into the wrong one. But it turns out that because I was in this hotel, this Ryokan, and one of the spas is nicer, every day they switch it. And I didn't see – I can't read Japanese. So I went into the women's room.
Uh-huh.
And
You're really encouraging me to do this.
It was an experience I won't forget. But by the way, so I heard your last segment a little bit that you're looking for translations, and I figure you're going to use Google Translate.
Yeah, I'm not. But a caller was looking for a translator from Swedish to English. I'm pretty happy with Google Translate, but I don't know how much am I going to need that.
You're not, well, especially with you're going with Talk and they have guides. You're not going to need it at all.
Yeah.
I mean, they're going to. I never used it in Japan, although there are times that I probably could have. But if you're with a guide, you don't need to. But I did just quickly look up some other another translation. It's called iTranslateVoice.com.
Okay.
And so it's mixed reviews on here. So it says 4 stars in Google Play and I think it was iOS, but. I was reading some of the comments. Some of them are like, oh, it's not good. But anyway, I'd love to see your opinion. But you can translate 40 languages. It's instant. And it looked – and I watched the video online, and they had Lost in Translation, but their tagline was – and that same – their video was the same look and feel as the movie Lost in Translation.
Yeah.
But it said – don't get lost.
Don't get.
I thought that was pretty clever.
Nice. It is really remarkable. This software is just remarkable that we can use software that will near real time translate, and it does. My experience has been it does a pretty good job, and it's getting better all the time. At first, translations were goofy.
Yeah.
But now they're pretty darn good.
It's changed in the world. 15 years ago or 10 years ago, I was in China and the taxi driver dropped me off at the wrong train station. I was late for a flight.
Oy.
And the only way I could communicate was putting my hands up like wings saying, I need to go to the airport. He's like, and I used to carry a book.
Yeah, phrase book. You would have to carry the little Berlin phrase book.
And that was just point.
Yeah.
Well, no, not even phrases.
Oh, have pictures.
It was only pictures, and I would point to the what I needed.
That works.
And there's apps like that do that as well.
Nice.
But I mean, you're going to have the best time.
It's going to be fun.
By the way, what cell phone plan are you using, or are you planning?
Oh, I'm set on that. So a couple of things. Yeah. In fact, I did a little research. Apparently, Wi-Fi is expensive and not as widespread in Japan as it is here in the U.S. We're all T-Mobile, so we get unlimited slow internet. I'm on Google Fi, which has a similar thing. But I bought a device, a MiFi puck, that will let you get Wi-Fi everywhere.
Right.
It's called Skyroam. Are you familiar with that?
I don't know Skyroam, but I've used MiFi's before.
So Skyroam, it's called the Skyroam Solus. I will come back and give you a review, but $8 a day for unlimited up to 5 devices. So that's, of course, a lot less expensive. Plus, it's high speed. It's 4G LTE. It has 16-hour battery life, which is important because I've had a MiFi before that dies after 5 or 6. That's kind of frustrating. Right. So what
but
I'll
the
do
buses
is
will ha- the buses will have electrical outlets.
Okay. But what I'll do is I will have, you know, we're going with our 15-year-old. So Lisa and I and Michael will all be tuned into the – well, I'll turn off data roaming on all the phones and tablets. because there's a few iPads in the group too, and just use this Skyroam and say, just pair with this and I'll have it in my pocket. So basically, as we walk around, we'll have Wi-Fi everywhere we go. And I hear that the LTE is pretty fast in Japan.
It is. You know, you're not going to have to worry about the T-Mobile. I had it, you know, when I was there in December, and I don't recall ever not being able to connect.
Yeah, they say 2G, but my experience has been, as I've used it over around the world, that it's often faster than that. Sometimes Correct. Very slow, but often faster. So anyway, I think we're pretty well set. But I wanted to review this Skyroam. You can rent the device or buy it. I bought it $149, and then you buy day passes, which is you use a day pass. It's $8 a day, $8 or $9 a day, depending on when you buy it.
It'll be interesting to see how that goes. And did you buy travel insurance?
Of course.
Your travel agent usually?
She always. And did Jane always goes to Allianz. I know.
She did go to Allianz. Oh, okay, yeah. Good, that is one of my sponsors. But I know. Even if you do the others, it's good.
We're
get it,
protected.
But make sure, since you do have Allianz, make sure you download their app, Travel Smart. Because what's good about their app is that it will show you which emergency services or the medical providers, which hospitals to go to. Also, if you get sick, you can contact them directly, although you're going to be with Talk, so you're not going to need to worry about that. But also, 911 numbers, emergency numbers are not the same universal in Japan.
Oh, I know.
For the police, it's 110. For ambulance or fire department, it's 119.
But this Travel Smart has all that information in it.
It does, but it's always good before you go to whatever country you go to, find out what the emergencies are, and this should have them handy in your phone, and that way, you know, or just have them handy in your head.
Well, we do have a few days on our own, you know, where we're not protected by a tour guide, so I mean, probably good to have all that stuff.
Yes, and I mentioned right before we went on the radio that get these fries, they're my favorite treat.
You get them at the airport, apparently.
At the airport, Potato Farm, they're called.
Potato Farm.
But they're like In-N-Out. French fries,
you know,
but crispy.
We've been subscribing for some time to a Japanese monthly snack box that has the weirdest Japanese snacks. This is for Michael. He's kind of one of the reasons we're going to Japan. He's fascinated with the manga, and he and his friends eat these weird snacks.
Like red bean and stuff.
Well,
I'm not into that.
Something weird. I wish we'd get these. What is it? Potato Farm fries. I might wish we'd get those.
Yeah. So, but I only find them in the airport. Whenever I go to a store in the city, they're like, I don't know.
Don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. But they go off like hotcakes in the airport. People are buying five boxes, and they usually have a minimum. You can't only buy five.
So I've got Travel Smart on here. You got a website or an app or anything else I should know?
I have another app called Brightly.
Brightly?
So, yeah, I've had it in my notes for a while to tell you about it. So I usually use Adobe Photoshop or Snapseed when I'm brightening up my photos because you know, everyone on Instagram is always touching up their photos, and you can do it in the app as well. Yeah. But Brightly, it does a good job just brightening them up because you could be taking a dark photo and you're like, oh, this photo's no good. You delete it. Don't delete it. At least try it with this app. It used to be free. They're now charging $2.99. But
That's not bad.
I find Snapseed very difficult to use. I mean, do you use Snapseed at all?
Yeah. I'm going to actually do a blog post about my whole photo workflow because it's going to be kind of kooky over there. Yeah. Johnny, we are out of time, but thank you. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More of your calls coming up right after this. Andy in New Jersey, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Leo. How you doing?
I'm well. Welcome.
I have a security question for you. You might think I'm being a little too paranoid. You might not. But first, I wanted to say thank you. And back in 2004, I was dealing with a situation where every parent and adult in my life was telling me to not go to school and get ready for Armageddon. And you responded to an email telling me to go to college and some other things.
Wait a minute. They were saying don't bother because the world's coming to an end?
Yeah, this was a long time ago we talked about that, but nonetheless.
Wow, so you did go to school. Yeah, you know, education. Do it because you love it, even if the world's coming to the end, and hey, maybe it won't come to an end, and you'll have a skill.
Yeah, well, you definitely set a 16-year-old kid straight. Now I'm 30 and I'm doing okay.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. It's nice to
and
talk to you.
Still here.
And it didn't come. You know what could happen tomorrow, but you have some fun while we're here. That's great, Andy. I'm glad to hear that. Thank you for telling me about that.
So as far as my situation goes, I have a work-at-home job, and
they have an iMac that hooks up to my Xfinity gateway router, and it's a connection I pay for, but their policy is that any visible traffic on the network from any device, even, you know, mine, they have the right to audit whenever they want.
Who's they?
And my employer, who shall remain nameless.
Yeah, so that's actually a good thing to keep in mind, that when you're on a work network or using work equipment, the employer has that right. They don't even have to tell you that. They just have the right.
Yeah.
So you're using a...
I figured that.
Do you pay for that? You said, though, that you pay for the Xfinity, or is that not the case?
I pay for everything except for the computer itself. So, and you know, I was thinking and doing some research on it.
If you use your computer on your network, they have no right to access that.
Yeah, that was my thought, too. However, human resources had other thoughts.
Well, you could sue the heck out of them. No. Are you on company time?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I guess if you're on company time. So part of this comes from not a desire to spy on you, but a very legitimate concern companies have over things like sexual harassment lawsuits. If they're responsible for creating a safe workplace, are you working at home?
Yeah, remote IT for a subcontractor that works for a larger
company. That's a little weird.
My concern is more or less, a rogue employee taking advantage of...
Yeah, spying on you. Hang on a second. I got to take a break. This is an interesting one. Maybe if there's a lawyer listening, we can get some help. 8888 Ask Leo. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Okay, so you work as a remote IT guy for this company.
Mm-hmm.
You use a company computer, but you pay for and use your own network.
Correct.
And then in order to do this, do you log into a company network?
Here's the setup. You know, I got the Xfinity router with, you know, three Ethernet connections. I ran myself one to their machine, which at times is not on the VPN, but most of the time is going to be software hooked up to their Cisco VPN. And I was thinking, you know,
so the auditing that they're doing,
adding a separate router. And
yeah. The auditing that they're doing is only of the stuff that you do over their VPN.
Yeah.
They could, in theory, have software on that particular PC that also monitors it and sends screenshots back to the home office, that kind of thing. But generally speaking, unless they're particularly aggressive, they're not monitoring other traffic. Like if you took another computer, got on your Xfinity, didn't do the VPN to work, but just used your router to go out to the outside world, they'd have no access to that. Unless they really want to be malicious.
Yeah, you know, like I was thinking, we're, you know, some random rogue employee, doing...
But he'd have to... In order to do that, he'd have to either put some malware on the router or malware on your other computers. Here's what my suggestion would be, that when you're doing this, disconnect the company computer from the router.
Well, that's the thing. They want it on all the time.
They want it on all the time.
Yeah, so they can do maintenance whenever they'd like and whatnot. And, you know, even when the VPN's off, they are able to remote desktop in and whatnot. And I'm thinking, well, if they're that far, they could easily look into my network shares.
Yeah, they're on your network. On your network. Yeah.
So would a separate router, like maybe a VPN router, a separate one hooked up to the Xfinity on a whole separate, you know, subnet of IPs be enough? Or too much?
So one way, let me think what you could do here. If they say that this is must be a persistent connection at all times, that their company provided desktop has to be on, VPN has to be running, connected to the router, and that router is obviously always connected to the internet, that means they're always keeping a channel open. Because their computer is on your network, it could be used to snoop on other network traffic. That's correct. The best way to...
I don't think it's their intent, but, you know.
The problem is that the Xfinity router, would they allow you... See, for instance, one of the things you could do is you could use a separate router to connect to the Xfinity router. You know, like one of these tiny hardware firewalls I'm always talking about. In fact, that might be the best way to do this. So you get a little firewall that you connect another computer to. It connects to the Comcast, but uses a VPN to go pass through the Comcast and out to another router. They would have no access to anything you do at that point. If you didn't use a VPN when you connect to the router, even if you used another router, they'd see that traffic because the traffic's not encrypted when it gets to the Comcast router.
Yeah, well, I was thinking of, you know, like you said, a router, VPN built in. That way I don't have to set up all my devices, individually.
Yeah.
My Xbox would even be on the VPN at that point.
Yeah.
I think that might be great.
You could do that. It's going to give you some overhead because of the VPN.
Yeah. I'm okay with that.
Do they insist that you use the Xfinity router? Is that part of the deal?
No. I was honestly thinking about getting a separate DSL.
That's what I would do.
CenturyLink phone line, just pay for the extra connection.
Another way to do this would be to get a more sophisticated. I don't like these Xfinity routers anyway. You still need to use the Comcast cable box, you know, the cable modem box, but you don't need to use its router. And get another router, like, say, the Ubiquiti Edge Router X, which lets you do VLANs, and you can do discrete LANs, one to your work desktop and one to something else. Hold on a second. We're going to come back. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy, 8888. Ask Leo the phone number if you've got a question, a comment, a suggestion. We've been talking to Andy, who has an interesting work situation. he's a remote IT guy. His company requires him to use a company laptop at home that's always connected to their virtual private network, and he may not turn it off. So his personal internet is being used by this company laptop to phone home at all times. His concern is that this company laptop, if somebody at work decided to be malicious, has access to his network. And you're right, Jonathan, it does. It's just sitting. And this is, by the way, the same thing we talk about with other Internet of Things devices, like an Amazon Echo or a Ring doorbell. When these devices are put on your home network, they are on your network. And if somebody were to commandeer them, they could use them to get on your network. So you trust your company. Its company's not going to do anything malicious. But it does, in fact, have a device inside the house, inside your network. So your best bet would be to isolate it somehow so that you could then do whatever you want without fear that anybody's spying on you. It's interesting the company's requiring this.
And they were fuzzy when asked directly because, you know, I asked HR about what I was signing. And I was like, the wording here is pretty all-encompassing, and they were pretty unsure. But
yeah, they're always going to document. Yeah, any legal document they're going to give you is always going to err on their side. That's, you know, I mean, but you don't want to hire a lawyer before you sign it, but that's really the right thing to do because they're not going to do anything to benefit you. Everything's going to be worded in such a way that they go to court, they have all the rights. And in fact, courts have always upheld employers do have a lot of rights. This is an unusual situation because the employer now is inside your house, which you have a right to privacy. You certainly, if they started spying on you, you'd have recourse. Because if you're using your personal, if you're using their computer, no. But if you're using your personal computer and they did something that to spy on you, even though you gave them permission to have their computer in your house, that would be illegal. So that's good to know. You are protected in that regard. I'm not a lawyer, but I'm pretty sure in that regard, no matter what you sign, they don't have the right to spy on your private traffic. Only stuff that you do on the work network with the work computer. In other words, the VPN and that computer. However, let's say you really do want to protect yourself. So because they have access to your network through the router, the best thing to do would be to isolate their computer from the rest of your network. And there are a couple of ways to do that. The Xfinity router you have may not have that capability, but many third-party routers do. It's something called VLAN or virtual local area network, where if you had, it's in effect two networks in your house, one for the company computer and one for everything else, you'd be safe because that company computer couldn't cross the barrier and see what you're doing. That's one, by the way, solution for Internet of Things devices. If you don't want your Amazon Echo to become a gateway to bad guys into your network, you put it on a separate network. And you can do that with a virtual LAN. So you could look for You'd have to keep using the Comcast cable modem, but you don't have to use their router. So you could have put their router in bridge mode so that it's not doing any routing. It's just a passive device. You'd need then there'd be a couple ways to do this. One would be have a dedicated router. Well, no, you want some isolation. There's one solution that comes from Xfinity. they call it XFi. They use plumes. These are those little silver things that the Plume router. And Plume has an interesting feature. It has a VLAN feature built into it. They don't call it that, but they have three network levels. They have a guest level, which has access to nothing but the internet. They have the homeowner level, which has access to everything. And they kind of have a middle level, which is internet only. The internet only level, you could put your corporate computer on the internet only level with a Plume, and then everything else that's going on would be isolated. That might be the solution. And you could do that without getting rid of your Xfinity router. You might inquire from Xfinity if you can get one of these Plume. And I don't know, and somebody who uses Plume on Xfinity would have to tell me if they give you access to all the features. This is a feature that's built into the regular Plume. But that's one of many routers that would do this. It's a VLAN is what you need. Another way to do this would be to disable the routing in the Xfinity. Get something, $50 hardware router, it's not Wi-Fi, called the Ubiquiti Edge Router X. It's inexpensive. It has four ports on it. Each of those ports could be on a VLAN, a separate LAN. A little complicated to set up, but you're a smart guy. You could figure this out. And by VLANing you can isolate them. So that's the key word to do some Googling on, is a VLAN. How to set up a VLAN in your house, a virtual network that is not visible to the corporate computer.
And if all else fails, I'll just get another ISP.
Yeah. You know what? If you got a separate ISP, I think you should make a case that, well, okay, fine, but you're going to be paying for this internet access through Xfinity.
Yeah.
Right?
That would be beautiful, but yeah, that's unfortunately not happening.
Yeah, sometimes you need a job more than you need to be right. So that's life, yeah. Right? And that's kind of what they're insisting on. And I think you're right. I don't think it's nefarious. They're trying to protect themselves. If you started, Bitcoin mining or serving pornography on their computer, they'd want to be able to see that. So they keep an eye on those kinds of things. Any company is going to do that, and legally has the right to do that. The trick is to isolate their computer from the rest of your house. If you get another router that has VLAN capability, that'll do it.
All right. I'll keep doing my research. I really appreciate your help.
Yeah, my pleasure. And thanks for telling me about those days long ago. I'm really pleased that worked out for you.
Yeah, I'm glad the world's still here and glad you are.
We're still here. We're not living in a bunker yet. Thanks. Yeah. Thanks, Andy. Take care. 8888, Ask Leo. Yeah, that's a more complicated networking issue, but it's something I think you all want to think about and keep in mind, that any device that you put on your network, your home network, has access to all the other devices. You know, the theory being that once you're on your own network, your personal network, it's a secure network. That's why you can get in trouble in a business. If somebody comes from home with their laptop has a virus, plugs it into your company's network, and it can then spread throughout the network. The network's presumed to be safe. Now, actually, more and more companies are adopting protection against that because it's happened. I think it happened to CNN. I remember somebody brought in a laptop, might even be a company laptop, but he infected it at home. Inside CNN, you can't get a virus because they have all sorts of antivirus protection right on inbound traffic. But the guy brought it home, got infected, brought it in. Now it's inside all that protection and infected everything else and brought a bunch of their computers to their knees. This was many years ago. Nowadays, we have ways to prevent that. So, and one of the ways is by segmenting, dividing up your network into pieces that can't talk to one another. The really primitive way to do this, my friend Steve Gibson calls the three router solution. I don't know if this is practical, but buying three routers, I don't even want to repeat it. It's so nutty. But you could Google the three router solution and see the kind of the map of how you would do this. One is connected to the outside world. One is connected to a less than safe network, maybe a bunch of – it's actually a good idea if you have a bunch of Internet of Things devices. Connect them to a separate router. And then the third router is your router for getting out into the world. Having a secure and an insecure local area network. I guess that would be the best way to describe it. If you Google three dumb routers, you'll either find a Three Stooges episode, or you'll find the three router solution to IoT security. Can't say it's certainly not the least expensive way to do this. Yet this year, like last year, I think we spent a lot of time talking about networking. It's really a big subject because all of a sudden you're doing the things at home that, you know, companies you spend a lot of money on and personnel on to do at work. And you're the IT guy now, or gal. Here's a topic that comes up all the time. And I wanted to put this in because I'm explaining this almost every week. And I think it's important. Do you need an antivirus? Watch. Bob Ventura, California. Hey, Bob.
Hey, Relio. How are you doing, bud?
I am great. Thank you.
I missed you. The last couple of weekends. I've been listening to you since I had a 12-foot satellite dish in my backyard.
Holy cow! On the Tech TV, yeah, ZD TV back then. Yeah.
And I followed a lot of your recommendations over the years. But one of the things I'm noticing recently is that you haven't been advocating for malware and antivirus stuff recently. And of course, while you were on vacation, I got a notice from ESET that my antivirus is expiring. And I'm in my memory, I don't see anything that they've ever caught that they've brought to my attention or quarantined. I see some block up ads come up every once in a while, must know if I allow or block. And so I'm kind of curious as to what I should be doing here. I do use Carbonite on my main business computer, and I do have five computers, two desktops, and three desktops and two laptops. And it is a business computer for one. And I do build niche and authority websites. So I'm confused as to what your recommendations are now about keeping the antivirus current, or just going to Carbonite, or making sure that all my computers up to Windows 10. So I'm a little confused. I wonder if you could point me in the right direction.
So it's a great question. And You said something very interesting, because people are saying, well, he's asking about antivirus, but then he's mentioning backup. But it is absolutely the case that one of the most important security measures you can take is to have good backups. And by good, I mean multiple copies, not just one. Ideally, three or more. One of them, at least one of them, off-site, out of the office, out of the building. So that if, you know, there's a fire or something, that you still have a good copy off, you know, off the premises. So you're doing that, which I like, and that's really important, because if you get bit by a virus, especially if it's ransomware, you know, the ones that encrypt your hard drive, having a good backup is going to save your life.
Okay, well, then let me ask you, one of my considerations is to make sure that all my computers are on Carbonite, and then I do have external hard drives, but they're connected to the computer, and I've been thinking about buying a second external hard drive for each computer, and then maybe every month alternating them, so I've got one air-gapped.
Yeah, so that's where the three come in. It's good to have Carbonite, but I also like having a local backup. And so it's nice to have a local backup. I mean, air-gap, you'd say, that's an interesting thing, too. That means you're not attached to the computer. And it is the case, if you left that external hard drive connected all the time and you got some of the malware viruses, would be smart enough to encrypt it as well, your backups as well as your originals. So Carbonite, that's not a problem, and it's not a problem if you're not always connected, if you're air-gapped, as you say. So that's all a good strategy. I don't anymore recommend buying antiviruses. That has changed. And I'm not sure I would say universally. There are some people who act dangerously on the internet. Having a good antivirus probably will help them a little bit. But you point out a really important point. You've not been bit by it because you're smart. You're updating your computer. You're not taking software from strangers. You're probably a little bit cynical when it comes to, you know, pop-ups and things like that. If that's called practicing safe computing, if you do that, an antivirus, in my opinion, is a negative, not a positive. Now, here's why it's a negative. All antiviruses, in order to work, hook themselves deep into the operating system, very deep, deeper than a normal application does. And as a result, if there's anything wrong with the antivirus, they're going to provide a conduit for a bad guy into your system. Yes, and this has happened. You can be hacked because your antivirus is not secure. And it's a bad hack because your antivirus is tunneled right into that kernel. So I think antiviruses potentially are less secure. They only catch at best half of all infections, some often less. And they don't catch the really problematic ones, the zero day, the ones that are that just happened. And a lot of ransomware is zero day where they don't know about it yet. They'll know about it in a week, but by then it's too late. So there's also the cost, and there's also the compatibility issues. Even if it's not a security issue, many security programs cause problems. A lot of the calls we get are from people. It's I have to say it's better than it used to be, but it used to be a lot. People would call, I can't get on the internet. Well, it turned out it was Norton or something that was blocking them from the internet. So, in general, I think an antivirus is not needed. For somebody who knows, as you do clearly, what you're doing, a good backup is needed always, but an antivirus is not needed. Now, if you have, unsophisticated users in your family, people who are doing, teenagers are notorious for this, an antivirus sometimes is the extra protection you need to keep them from infecting the computer. I'd prefer to teach them what not to do than anything else. We have a 15-year-old. For a long time, every time, I would go on his computer, be laden with not so much malware, but adware and spyware and stuff, because he'd go to free sites and download, the Five Nights at Freddy's free version, that kind of thing. And so I spent, instead of, loading his system up with security software, I spent time with him explaining, if you're going to go to a site to download free software, see how this happens, talk to me first or make sure that, we haven't, ever since we kind of did that training, haven't had a single problem. He's learned how to be a safe computer user. And I think it's not a hard thing to learn. I think that's probably the better thing to do than to say, rely on some, software system to protect you, particularly since these software systems aren't full protection, often add security flaws and can slow your system down or even make it unusable. So the answer is no, don't. Windows 10 particularly is really secure. It comes with a built-in antivirus called Defender. So you do already have some protection. I think modern operating systems, whether it's OS 10, Mac OS, or Windows, are very secure. So keep doing what you're doing. I like the idea of a local backup, absolutely, in addition to the offsite. That's the three copies, the original and two backups on two different media or two different styles. And that's what you're doing. And I like the air gapping. I think that's a good idea. One of the things I used to do is I'd have a network attached storage device at work, back up to it, then bring it home and have a duplicate device at home, which I'd bring to work. And that way I always had an offline up-to-date backup. There's ways to do this. And I think that, you're on the right track. So let's talk photography. Chris is always good here for inspiration, helping us get better images, even with a camera phone. What do you got for us today?
Well, it is very camera phone related this time, and I've again brought three apps that I like. They are somewhat photography related. They're more on the fun side, but every now and then you should have fun with your photos. And I just like playing with photos sometimes. One is a selfie-specific app. It's called Sticky AI. And what it does is you take a selfie, and it cuts you out. So it takes the background out automatically.
It doesn't cut you out. It cuts the background out.
It cuts the background out.
I'd like to see more selfies without people in them.
All right. You can put text on that. You can put a white border around you. And then you can just send it to apps like Messenger, Telegram, Skype, and so on. It's available for iOS, Android. And it's amazing how much fun I had with this little app. Or you can combine it. If you're on iOS, you can combine it with another software that's called Adhesive, which creates iMessage stickers. So you can put yourself in iMessage and then put yourself on other people's photos.
Oh, that sounds fun. I like that. All right, downloading both of those now. All right.
Well, you're gonna download the next one too. It's GIF Toaster. It's GIF, not GIF, right? Or is it?
I say, you know what I do? Because I don't want to be stuck. I say it both ways. Sometimes I say GIF. Sometimes I say GIF. because it's such a crazy battle. I don't know. What do you say, GIF? So,
I say GIF.
Yeah, because it's short for graphics interchange format. It's a key. But doesn't the guy who invented it, didn't he say it's GIF?
I think so, but hey, you put a T at the end, it's gift. That's not pronounced gift. So anyway, Gift Hoster. That's only for iOS, though. It's a GIF-related app. It makes GIFs out of videos, live photos, bursts, time lapses, panoramas, and then you get to send them off or save them. Another one that is also available for Android that's also GIF-related that lets you make GIFs and put text on them and put graphics on them is Giphy Cam, which is a nice one too. That's available for both platforms. But my iOS GIF app of choice right now is Gift Hoster. Like you take one of these live photos that have a bit of motion in them, but then you put them into a GIF, and then when you share them to others, they can immediately see those, no matter what platform they're on.
You know, I hate the Apple Store search. I can never find anything. GIF Hoster, is that what it is?
Gift Toaster. Toaster.
Toaster. Oh.
Toaster. Well,
that's a user.
The thing with the bread.
Like bread. Gift Toaster.
Yeah.
Oh. That's also, is that available on Android as well?
No, but no. The one GIF app that is great on Android is Giphy Cam.
Giphy Cam.
G-I-P-H-Y
okay.
Cam.
Okay.
Which does a lot of fun things.
Okay.
And now, here's the last one, which I talked about with my co-host on the Future of Photography recently. When we were talking about glitch art. Have you ever heard of glitch art?
No. You're it's so like with it and hip. I don't know any of this
stuff. Photos that look like there was some sort of a glitch, a digital glitch, an analog glitch, something broke. And who doesn't like to like destroy a few photos every now and then? Go a bit creative and use so-called glitch filters. There's filters. There's an app called Decimate, D-E-C-I-M, and then the number 8. And you get to combine like a whole bunch of different filters. They have weird names like Graboid or Glass Dagger or Brain Feeder. And they do things with photos that look very analog sometimes and that look like, well, they look quite artful, to be honest. And
they look like Max Headroom. Did you have
some
Max
of them
Headroom
look like
Germany?
Max Headroom?
Yeah.
Well, no. Well, yeah. I think a bit of that. But you can press different like random buttons there. You can combine multiple filters. You have a per filter set of parameters, so you can change those. You can randomize those, and then you can apply them to still photos, but you can also live preview them, and that's it's just fun to do that from now.
The first few are free within app purchases, as always. This one's 99
cents,
which is nice because I would rather pay 99 cents up front than, you know, I bought an app, which I don't recommend, a black and white filter, because I like black and white, called Carbon, $20 later to get all the filters, and I didn't like any of them.
You should try Decimate. Just destroy a few photos.
I have installed every single one. Every single one of your apps here on my iPhone. Nice.
Well, you'll have fun playing with those. Now, I want to see some sticky AIs, some selfies.
That sticky AI is kind of cool.
Yeah.
Now, I know we went fast, and don't worry. Don't freak out. I know there are people pulling over right now and pulling out a pad of paper. It's okay. It's all going to be on the website, techguylabs.com. We'll put links to all of these. So you could just click them and download and make it much easier for you, techguylabs.com. We'll also put a link to Chris Marquardt, discoverthetopfloor.com. And then Burke sent me a picture of you on the this is you on the Autobahn today.
Well, that was me on the passenger seat, luckily. And that's, by the way, Gift Hoster. I used a live photo and I put it through Gift Hoster, so that's a GIF.
Ah, nice. And you know what's cool? It doesn't obviously repeat. I thought it was
continuous.
That's
live photos, though. That's a loop from live photos that does the repetition. From the repetition, it looks nice.
The Apple Live Photos app?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Have you never tried this? If you take a live photo, do that right now. Do that right now. Take a live photo, enable in the camera the live photo mode.
Yeah.
Just this little concentric circle on the top.
On. Yeah.
Take a photo of something that moves.
Okay. Doing it. Yeah.
Okay. Now go to edit the photo.
Okay.
And swipe up.
Go to edit. Okay, so here we're doing this now. That was you. And if I press and hold it, it shows you waving. Okay.
Okay, now swipe up.
Now press edit.
On the photo.
Oh.
No.
Oh, don't press edit. Just swipe up.
Swipe up.
Oh, loop.
And now select loop.
Oh, it's making a loop. Ah, there's a little dissolve in there, but on your snow thing, you don't see
swipe
the dissolve.
Swipe up again, yeah. And choose bounce.
Bounce, that's back and forth.
Exactly. And you can make those into gifts with the gift toaster.
How did I not know this?
I thought you knew this.
I probably knew it and forgot it.
This long exposure thing, by the way, is if you shoot water, you will get like a blurred water.
Oh,
effect.
Nice. Nice.
Very cool. Very beautiful.
Nice. You know, I mostly take pictures with the Pixel 2 because I like the camera better, but it doesn't have this particular feature on it. So I'm going to have to start doing more iPhone. So tell me again, I got Sticky, forget carbon.
Sticky AI.
Sticky AI.
Adhesive.
I got to get this other one. What is it called? Adhesive?
Adhesive.
Adhesive. Just
adhesive. Which makes iMessage stickers out of every photo. Any photo you like.
Oh. Create stickers for iMessage. Yep. Okay. 99 cents. So now I could do a selfie. And make it
put
a
it
sticker.
Into adhesive, and then you can stick your own bug on iMessages.
I'm going to make a little folder of these things here so I can do this whole production. So there's the sticky. So let me do a sticky.
Yeah, do a sticky.
Sticky would like to access the camera. Okay. Swipe full down. Face. Oh, no. First, before I have to do that, I have to do... Sticky's the one, right?
Oh, yeah? Sticky is fine.
Okay. All right, that's the sticky.
Hopefully it can handle the headphones. But
look at
not
that.
Good. Not too well. Not
take
too
off
well.
The headphones. Okay, so let's not do that. Let's take off the headphones. All right, take it. Hold to make a GIF. So it's, you can animate this as well.
Now you're getting an animation.
Yeah, but see, there's something about the side of my head it doesn't like.
It's probably the studio lighting that trips it.
Can you fix this or is it just, you just...
You can. I think you can swipe on it.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting.
Zoom in.
That's amazing, though, that can do that. Wow.
Well, or you get a nicely, weirdly shaped head there, but that's okay.
Yeah, I have it was the microphone. Never mind. Let me do it without the microphone.
There we go.
Yeah, that's better. All right. Share data. Yeah, of course. It's got a little light there. So, but that one's pretty good. Okay.
So give it a wide border. Tap on the photo.
Yeah. Ah!
Tap again.
Oh, this is fun.
You have a few filters there.
Yeah. Okay.
And tap the person on the right top, the third from the top.
That's
so
the white border.
White border.
Okay, yeah.
Now save it to your camera roll.
Okay. Save to, whoops.
Saved. Oh, if you tap the background, it changes the color of the background.
Do I not want that? I want transparent, don't I?
If you want to make a nice little sticker, then you go transparent.
Slow down, Leah.
Slow.
I got to do a show. I'll talk there to you later, go. Chris. Thank you.
Talk to you. Take care.
Dom, Mission Viejo, California. Hello, Dom.
Hi, Leo. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Good. Hey, Leo. So I'm thinking about putting... TV in my backyard, so I need to up my Wi-Fi.
A TV in your backyard. Is it going to be a projector, or is it going to be a big screen that's in a sheltered area? Or
yeah, just a flat screen that I'm going to. I have a pergola in the back of my house. I was going to mount the flat screen to it, and I was going to use the internet instead of putting a cable onto it. So. You know, my Wi-Fi in the backyard isn't all that great. So I went to Costco last week and I picked up the Google Wi-Fi, the mesh system.
Okay.
And hooked that up. And just a really simple question. This is just, and the Wi-Fi works great. And I recommend it, by the way. It's really increased the speed in my house.
Mesh is a big improvement for almost everybody. Yeah.
When you're testing, doing the speed test, and this is the geek part of me, it seems like every test I use, whether it's the test that comes with the Wi-Fi system itself, or whether you go to the Google, the search engine, or if you use another, it seems like the numbers are always different.
Yeah.
You never really know what the reading is, the ups and the downs.
Right.
How do you get a true reading of the speed? And again, I am getting good speed. I just would love to know what it is.
You want a number. And of course your internet service provider gives you a number, but if you read carefully, there's a little tiny, right next to the 100 megabits is a number, a word, two words, up to, that tell you what they're giving you is the maximum possible. They're not guaranteeing that. They're not even saying you're going to get that. It just may be as fast as. So that's the first thing to understand, and that's why people do speed test. So let me. This question has a lot of factors to it. And in fact, it's been even more complicated by your choice of Wi-Fi router, and I'll explain that at the end. Of course, the first thing is your internet service provider, especially if you're on cable, is inconsistent. This is less true on DSL if you're on a phone line. And this comes back to what that wire that's coming into your house is connected to. At whatever point it's connected to the broader internet. So if you think about your internet service provider, let's say they have a big tube that is their total internet access coming into their premises, and then they connect it to a switch which divvies it out to all the customers. You, all the customers, are dividing that big tube into little amounts. And it will fluctuate if they have so many customers that one or two or 100 customers can bring the total down. You know, if they're such bandwidth hogs that they use up more than half of the big tube, you're going to get less. It's less of a problem on DSL because in most cases, DSL is coming from the switch at the phone company and they have more bandwidth. You're not impacted by your neighborhood. You're impacted by the total usage on that central office. Cable modems, the way they work is they have a backhaul that comes down to a box that's in your neighborhood. And so that's a smaller amount than the big tube that the cable company's getting. And that smaller amount is shared by you and your neighbors. And your neighbors are usually around 100 people. So you will notice that your bandwidth goes down, for instance, especially on a cable modem. It could go up down on a DSL as well, but mostly it doesn't because telcos have big pipes. And statistically, it's more evenly shared because more people are connected to that main switch. With you, if you have a bandwidth hog next door or you have, let's say you have a neighbor next door with three teenagers and all three teenagers are watching YouTube and your neighbor's watching Netflix, they're drawing a lot of bandwidth. And that's why most homes in cable neighborhoods notice a drop in bandwidth around 6 o'clock at night, prime time viewing, because people are streaming. And cable companies don't really up the amount of bandwidth to that head end near you. They have a kind of a single amount that they're pumping in there. And so you're dividing it more up at night. So you will notice that fluctuation. So that's one cause of fluctuations, literally fluctuation in available bandwidth from the internet service provider. The next thing that happens, of course, is in your own home, and it's exactly the same problem, but locally, you've got one pipe coming into your home, and then if you've got three teenagers watching YouTube, good luck getting high speed because you're dividing your total amount up by those people. There's another thing that can impact the speed, and that's the speed of the device you're using. Internet, mostly these days, comes from Wi-Fi. The Wi-Fi radios in your phone, laptops, other devices are not all made equal. Some are better than others. Some are faster than others. And so you may find you've got two phones in front of you, and one's Android, one's iOS, and the speeds are dramatically different. That's the hardware or the operating system. Both can have an impact on it. So a Mac laptop might get different speeds than a Windows laptop. The hardware in the Windows laptop, the Wi-Fi hardware, might be different. That is less of a problem when you're physically connected by a wire, Ethernet wire, but most people are on Wi-Fi. Now you're adding, and this is the last piece of the puzzle, mesh. And one thing that all mesh devices claim to do, some do more than others, is bandwidth shaping. So your Google Home is supposed to be, and I don't frankly know if Google does this or not. I know some do. My Eero does it, for instance. That's another mesh company. Watch what's going on. And it says, right now, Dom's just getting email. So give him 3 megabits because in the other room, his wife is watching a UHD Netflix movie, she needs 25 megabits to watch that. So it's bandwidth shaping, and it literally is because it knows. This is why mesh is better. One of the reasons mesh is better. It knows what devices are on there, and it's constantly shaping the bandwidth to each device to accommodate the device's needs. So when you run a speed test, it may, you know, it'll vary depending on what other people in the house are doing, not only because they're all sharing the same amount of bandwidth, but because your mesh modem may also be saying, no, I see you running speed test. I'm not going to let you buffer your wife's movie. That would be wrong. So all of this makes it very hard to get a single number. I'll tell you what I would recommend. If you want to get a sense, all you're ever going to do is get a sense, is you do the test at multiple times throughout the day. And you probably want to use different servers. So there's speedtest.net. There's an app for that. There's a website. But there are other speed tests out there. I like Broadband Reports has one that's very good. You can use that as well. And then Netflix has its own test that is actually a test of how well you connect to Netflix servers directly. That's at fast.com. So I would do speedtest.net, fast.com, and broadbandreports.com. That's three different tests, three different servers. None of them will give you the same number, and it will vary depending on time of day, but at least you'll be able to get an idea of the shape of what's going on. And that's useful. There's other factors, by the way, than just download and upload speed. There's download speed is the most important one. Upload speed is relevant, though, because one of the things that happens when you're uploading data to the internet, each packet you upload needs a packet from the download saying, I got it, next one. And it's easy to saturate your upload and make downloads impossible. So even if you're only uploading a little bit, it can actually make your downloads much, much slower. So that's another factor. And so look at downloads. You should also look at latency, which is the amount of time it takes to send a single packet to the server and back. That's important. High latency means bad voice over the internet, bad gaming. And then there's something called jitter, which is like latency that will also impact voice over the internet. All of these factors make a picture of your internet access. In other words, that number that the company's given you, you get 100 megabits down, is basically meaningless. Leo LaPorte, the tech guy. We're going to continue in just a second before we go on with Dick DiBartolo, Mads, Maddest Writer, and one of the best features on our show. I just want to remind you, we're doing a little survey. We do this once a year. A lot of you are geeks. Maybe you use collaboration software at work, and we'd like to know a little bit more about that. This helps us plan our programming, but also helps us with advertisers. The survey's brief, takes about 6 minutes. We do not want any personal data. We don't collect it. We don't send it to anybody. So don't worry. I know that's important to you. It's certainly important to me. Your personal data is safe with us. It just helps us better understand the audience. So go to twit.to/survey12. A couple of minutes. You can do it while you're listening. I appreciate it. Kind of a little gift to us this holiday season. Thank you. twit.to/survey12. Now, let's get ready for Dick DiBartolo. Well, I think Damien, our new musical director, has figured out that Dick DiBartolo is a man about town in his white pants and his Tony Manero hair. Whether you're a brother or whether you're a lover, you're staying alive. Staying alive.
Yeah.
Dick DiBartolo's here, our gizmo wizard. We call him the Giz Wiz. Hello, Dickie D.
Leo, how you doing?
I'm good. How are
good.
You?
You know, I did a mad album of disco satires.
Did you?
With a guy named Norm Blagman. And the takeoff on this was called Barely Alive.
Barely Alive. Barely Alive.
Barely Alive. Yeah.
I miss those. They used to bind the little vinyl records into Mad Magazine.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
The only one I remember, and it's probably because I was 12 years old at the time, was one called It's a Gas, where it's basically...
Oh, my gosh, yes.
It was a little vinyl, you know, it's like a floppy little vinyl record bound in there, and I had a record player. This is how long ago this was. And you put it on there, and you usually have to put a lot of weight on it, because the thing is...
Yes, it would always say, please put a 25-cent piece on it.
Weight on it.
Yes.
And then all it was people burping. It would play some music.
Yeah, I was one of those people.
What? You were a burper?
I was... I was a burper.
The chorus? The burper's chorus? Yes,
we actually did disco It's a Gas.
Did you really?
Yes, we did. And there were two of us, and someone in the control room said, oh, you need a burp? Just buy some soda that's warm. And if you drink warm tonic water, I think we were drinking.
Boogie! And here it is, ladies and gentlemen, direct from Mad Magazine, the disco version of It's a Gas. Is this you too? Oh, man! I can't take you anywhere! Wow.
Yeah, well, if next time we have dinner, I'll do it for you live.
Promise?
No.
Do you have a gizmo for? I'm going to leave this music going in the background. This is the best thing ever. All right.
I do. So there's a show. It's just a single day show called Kid and Family Tech Expo, and it was last week. And I found this neat thing. The company is called Curiscope, and it's the virtual IT shirt. Okay.
Okay. You better explain this.
Yes, Leo. So you put the shirt on, and then you download the app, and you hold your phone or your iPad or whatever your electronic device is up to the shirt, and it shows you your insides.
What?
It's really, really neat.
That's
and kids
wild.
Will like it because it says,
it's an X-ray.
See your insides in gross detail.
Oh, man. This is what's in the back of the magazine. I don't think Matt ever had these. But in the back of comic books, the X-ray specs.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Except this is a little more accurate. I mean,
accurate? I bought those X-ray specs. You couldn't see anything.
No. Yeah.
That was the biggest ripoff of... That was when I learned at a young age that life was... Not fair.
Right. I believe what they did was there is a piece of a feather in there so that there was some liney thing.
It was
that
fuzzy.
They're passing off.
Yeah,
as an
I thought I'd see something much more interesting, and I did not.
You did not.
No.
Exactly. No, this is obviously not your body, so you can't write it off on Medicare. Medicare will not
you
pay
can't,
for
you,
it.
Do not use for diagnosis. Okay.
Exactly. Yeah. I said to the guy, I hope this is my insides because you'll save me a trip to the hospital. And then you can tap on different organs, and there's a lecture person who can tell you about that.
Oh, wow.
If you want, you can have the heart rate be your heart rate.
What?
By going into the heart rate app, putting your finger over the lens of your camera, it will pick up your heart rate and then let the heart the app beat at the sound.
This is augmented reality. That's what this is.
Yes, it is. Actually, the guy said if you have VR glasses, you can go in and do a 360 tour.
Now, if you will it move around? I mean, will your bones move around and stuff?
You know what? I didn't see that.
You can put it on a teddy bear, apparently. I didn't know teddy bears had organs.
Yes. Also, you can wear the sheet the shirt yourself and just put it in selfie mode.
Oh,
and then look at your own.
This is cool.
Inside.
I like this.
This is great.
Yeah.
And it's $29.95.
Oh, I like it even more now.
You're going to like it even more because for some reason I checked before the show, and from yesterday to today, it's down to $24 on Amazon.
Wow. Okay, so it's just a T-shirt.
Yeah, it's just a T-shirt.
But the app is free that you'd use?
The app is free. And the guys who did it, I met the inventor of it. It's a young guy. I think they spent a lot of money, you know, getting it up and running. So he deserves his
$24. Everybody buy one right now. You go to gizwiz.biz. That's Dick's website, gizwiz.biz. Click the button that says the Gizwiz visits the tech guy, and you can get a link and find out all about the beautiful skeleton T-shirt, the virtuality. That's pretty cool. I really like it.
Cool.
And it's Curiscope, C-U-R-I, like curiosity, Curiscope. By the way, while you're at Dick's site, gizwiz.biz, click the link that says what the heck is it, because we have a brand new.
Brand new one.
So this, and so now you can, now it can be told. The last.
Do you have any vague idea really what that is, Leo?
So it's it looks like kind of like a one of those clickers that goes.
You got it.
Is it?
Yes. It was a dog or any pet, or actually they used to use them in school too. When I click it once, everybody stands.
Yes.
When I click it twice, everybody sit down.
I used to have these when I was a kid. I love these things. Wow. I got it. Yeah. I should have entered.
Yeah.
I could have won a Mad Magazine.
Exactly. Yeah. You can enter the new contest.
They used this, somebody mentioned, in Jurassic World to train the raptors.
Yep.
A lot of good that did. And I remember it from a TV show called Goliath, where William Hurt, who was a very nasty brute of a lawyer, used it. Whenever he got angry, he'd click at you.
Oh, my gosh.
It's very annoying.
Oh, my gosh.
So now we have a new one, and boy, this one's a mystery. It's a close-up picture
of
a gizmo or a gadget. If you can identify it, you can enter the drawing for one of six Mad Magazines for the right answer, 12 for the best wrong answer, and Dick signs them all, and he's the sole one and only judge. Gizwiz.biz. Gizwiz.tv for Dick's great gizmo podcast that he does with Chad Johnson. Well, thank you, Dickie D.
Okay, buddy. I'll talk to you next week.
Talk to you next week. Jane, Manhattan Beach is next. Hi, Jane. Leo Laporte. Thank you for hanging on.
Hi, Leo.
Hello. Sorry. Didn't mean to startle you. How you doing, Jane?
I'm doing well.
Good.
And really like listening to all the people who've talked this morning.
Thank you.
Yes. Let's see. I tried to make notes so I could make sure I remembered everything. I'm inquiring about LastPass or something similar, and I have a gazillion passwords. Of course, all of them have to be different.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
Even I reuse passwords sometimes. Just remember that when you do that, all the sites then are somewhat insecure.
Yes.
So I only do it on things like my newspaper login, things like that, where so what if a bad guy got that? That wouldn't be the end of the world.
I hope. Okay.
Yeah.
So the other part of this is that I'm looking on the LastPass site, and I thought I would get some ideas, like what to look out for. So I cannot find any – well, they've got testimonials – the topic, but it does not open. So my inquiry to you today is, what should I look out for when using LastPass and or a similar one that you might recommend? And I do have another part to that.
Well, first let me say LastPass is a sponsor of many of our shows. So I love LastPass. I've used it for 10 years, practically since they started. They only became a sponsor recently, but I've recommended it for all 10 years. But there are many other good similar ideas, the password managers, that's what these are called. The idea is that instead of having to remember passwords, you put them in a secure vault, which is a digital file, but a secure vault. And all you have to remember is the one password that opens the vault. You can even secure it further, which I'd recommend, with two-factor authentication. So you enter the password, but the first time you use a vault on a new device, you'll have to also enter a code that you'll get from your phone. That way, even if a bad guy got the password, he still wouldn't be able to unlock your vault. The vault itself is totally secure, and I would say this is true of all the major players, 1Password, LastPassword. There's KeePass, Dashlane, quite a few of these. I like LastPass because, we vetted the software early on with the creator, Joe Segrest, and I think they've kept up. The other reason I use LastPass is it works on every machine I use, Windows, Mac, Android, iOS, even on Linux machines. They have a Chrome browser plugin and so forth, so it makes it very easy for me. When I set up a new machine, one of the first things I set up is LastPass. Now I've got all my passwords available to me to quickly set up. It's not just websites, to set up apps as well with their passwords. So were you asking about best practices with LastPass, or what is your concern, or what issues would you like to know more about?
Well, anything that I put on the internet, I'm concerned about.
Yeah, so remember, LastPass doesn't protect anything but your passwords or what you enter in there. So if you're on a website and you give them a credit card number, LastPass isn't protecting that. It can store the credit card number in LastPass. In fact, I do that. But once you give it to somebody, it's out of LastPass's hands, and unfortunately yours as well. So if you use a credit card on Amazon, for instance, it's used, and Amazon has that. If they were to get broken into, the good news is you could easily reset your password. But once you give a password or credit card or any other information to a site, it's no longer protected. It's only protected, you know, in LastPass so that you can use it. But as soon as you use it, you're telling somebody the password.
Well, and then on LastPass, it is the password that is protected.
Yes, it's stored in LastPass in a secure fashion. So even if somebody could somehow hack into LastPass, they wouldn't be able to get that password. Only you can see that. And not just password. As I said, I use it, and any password manager, this would be the same, to store credit card numbers. I put driver's license and passport images in there. Any social security numbers, anything that I want to remember, but I want to keep safe, I keep in that vault. Think of it as it's like a physical vault. It's a secure vault that only you have access to. But once you take something out of the vault and give it to somebody, LastPass is no longer taking care of it. They do have a nice security checkup feature you might want to run that will go out and say, oh, you're using the same password on these 42 sites. And they even have a system that kind of helps you change those to more secure passwords. The point of a password manager is that not only will it store the passwords, it will help you generate really secure, long passwords. The problem with a secure password is not memorable. If it's memorable, it's not secure.
Yeah.
It's totally random. It's a weird combination of letters and numbers and punctuation marks. It's totally random. And it's long. It's more than 8 characters. It's 10, 12, as long as you can make it, 30, 40, 50. The longer you make it, the more secure it is. And so a password manager, password vault, will generate these very long, very strong passwords and then remember them for you. Because no one could. Mr. Memory couldn't remember all of these. So from now on, once you start using a password manager, you should let it generate the passwords and generate a unique one for each site. That's the most secure practice to use. And whenever you can, LastPass doesn't say this, but it is true. If a site offers this thing, do you know what I mean when I say two-factor authentication?
That I have to give two pieces of information in order to prove that I'm the person on the account.
A+, gold star, putting that right on your forehead there. that's exactly it. And the two pieces of identification usually are in two different categories. So there's three ways to – it's all about proving you're you, right? What we call identification authentication. And it's something you know, which is a password. Something you have, which could be a little dongle, a physical thing. Your phone is something you have. And then something you are, which is your iris or fingerprint scan. Those are the three kinds of authentication. Two-factor ideally chooses types from two different styles. So a password that's in your head or in your password manager and a 6-digit code generated by an app on your phone. That would be very secure. A bad guy would have to both know your password and then get your phone or hack it somehow to get both pieces of information. That makes it more than twice as hard. I guess that's the point. It's not impossible, but it's just really, really hard.
Well, good to have that extra feature on there.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Use it whenever you can is my bottom line there. Yeah.
Definitely, yes. In looking on the site, what it is, it says, yes, there is a free offer.
Yeah.
Then I'm looking further, and all I can find is upgrade to, granted, $2 a month is nominal.
Yeah.
However, I can't find it that would continue with just the...
I think if you just download it and run it, it'll run. It just won't do some of the things you might want to, like, for instance, run on a smartphone. And they'll show you what the premium features are. But that's, to me, the most important premium feature is the ability to run not just on a computer, but everywhere on smartphones, tablets, and computers. And that you do pay for. But as you say, $2 a month is not outrageous. It used to be $1 a month.
Oh,
Okay. Yeah.
Well, either one would be fine.
I think it just depends if you need it. If there are free password managers, almost always the free password manager is less convenient in some way. For instance, if you use Apple's have built-in password managers on iOS and macOS, but they don't work anywhere but iOS and macOS. So if you ever have to use Windows or an Android phone, they're not very useful. So it's things like that that, you know, you can get free ones, but they'll be less useful than, I think, a paid one. And if you look at other ones, I mean, LastPass is great. It's what I use, but 1Password is also very good. Dashlane is also very good. Those would be my three favorites.
Okay, and you think that doing the next one up, i.e. the $2 a month, is better than getting the free one?
Only if you need those features. So there is a table, I'm sure, somewhere saying, here's what you get when you pay for it.
There is.
Yeah.
Yes.
If you need any of those, pay for it. If not, don't.
Okay, and they'll keep going for as long as I want it?
I hope so. they're a sponsor. Even if you don't pay, the password vault does not go away, just the capability of using it on an Android or iOS phone.
Oh, so they would keep it, and,
yeah.
And then if I continued later on, I would have it?
That's right.
Cool. Okay, thank you so much for everything today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm really glad you called, Jane, because you're doing the single most important thing you can do to keep yourself secure.
Good. Okay.
I think it's real. I've got my mom to do it. All my family members, of course, they all fell off the wagon right away because it's too much trouble. Everybody wants to just use birth date and dog's name for your password. But when you hear about 500 million accounts leaked by Marriott and the passwords leaked, if you use that same password on many sites, all of those sites would be compromised. You would now have to go out and change the password, and you'd have to remember where you used it. That's why a password vault is really, really important. You got to use one. You gotta. I know it's not as convenient. There is a definite trade-off between convenience and security, but it's not that inconvenient. Err on the side of security. Well, I hope you've enjoyed our best of. It was kind of fun putting this together. Thanks to Karsten Bondi, who put a lot of work into this. Did Josh Windisch also? I bet he did. Josh knows the show better than anybody. He has to listen to it every week. Better than me. I just have to do it. I am so glad you listen. I really appreciate it. To each and every one of you, have a wonderful holiday season. I hope you get to do something fun. I hope you get to take some time off and relax, put your feet up. And I think you share with me our wish for a happy and peaceful 2019. Have a wonderful new year, and I'll see you next week on The Tech Guy. Bye-bye. Well, that's it for The Tech Guy Show for today. Thank you so much for being here. And don't forget, TWIT, T-W-I-T. It stands for This Week in Tech, and you'll find it at twit.tv, including the podcasts for this show. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on Mac Break Weekly, iPads, iPhones, Apple Watches on iOS Today, Security on Security Now. I mean, I can go on and on. And on. And of course, the big show every Sunday afternoon, This Week in Tech. You'll find it all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next week with another great Tech Guys show. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time.